Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, Nicks? What the fuckadelics? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Welcome to it. I am, I'm back. I'm back in my garage. I'm sweating. I'm back from Montreal. And it was a good time. And I don't say that lightly, even though I got an email from a woman named Connie who insists that all I do is talk about how great I am and how talented I am and how well I'm doing with comedy. She says that's all I do on every show, and that, you know, she's concerned I might be entering into a danger zone because all I'm talking about is how talented I am, and no other talented people talk about how talented they are. And it's just she's concerned as a fan that I'm I guess being too confident and enjoying myself. Connie, fuck right off. Seriously, Connie, stop listening, please. I can't take the condescension and your fucking, you know, buzzkill soul suck. Just fuck right off and stop listening. I don't care how big a fan you are. Don't write me and tell me to stop talking about how much fun I'm having doing stand-up. Finally, after 40 years, Mark can finally talk about having a good time without feeling some sort of weird shame or disingenuousness. And fucking Connie says, back off the self-praise and excitement and pride. Back off. It's too much. It's unseemly, Connie said. Unseemly, Connie said to pull back from enjoying yourself. Connie, let me tell you directly, and all the Connies out there, I had great shows up in Montreal. I mean, really great. And can I just say that, you know, despite what anybody thinks or what anybody knows or to whatever criticism may come to me from people who don't like themselves or sense a tone, this new set is good. I'm doing good work. And I had fun in Montreal, despite the fact that Connie buzzkilled me and all the Connies. For all the Connies, fuck right off. But see, now some people go, she got under your skin, you let her get at you, that's all she wanted. Is it? You know, I don't know what people do or what people say. I just see what they write sometimes, whether on any media, social media platform, whether it's Instagram, whether it's Twitter, whether it's my email. It's like, did a human being sit down and write this on purpose in a conscious state? You at some point you're like, hey, I'm going to do this. I'm going to send this email. And 99% of the time, it's a them problem. And I appear to be some sort of passive garbage can for their projections and psychic refuse. No. No can do. No Connie dumping in this fucking can. So listen, Neil Gaiman is on the show today. And Neil Gaiman is a very prolific fantasy writer, novelist, short story writer, comic writer, Sandman, American Gods, Stardust, Coraline, and Good Omens, which he co-wrote with Terry Pratchett, are all books he's written. The Sandman comic book has been adapted to a live-action series for Netflix and premieres this week. And I'm not a deep Gaiman nerd, but I did go through a Sandman period. I spent my time with the Sandman. during a very weird part of my life when I was in a slightly drug-induced psychosis, psychotic state, post-Los Angeles, post-first shot at sobriety, and my brain was fucked. It was highly mystical, mystically paranoid. I didn't go with the big pharma Jew-run world thing. I went right to the completely fucking vague demons and dwarves and gods and signs and symbols, magic. And somehow Hellblazer and Sandman were not just entertainment for me, they were journalism. Yeah, journalism. You hear me? That's how fucking out of my mind I was back in the 80s for a couple years, where I thought Hellblazer were like, no one knows this, but this is just the facts. Sandman, no one knows this, but he's just reporting on what is. So look, Montreal. I think I talked about it leading up to it, that I was having some kind of PTSD-related spite triggers from having gone there in 1995 as just some sort of dirk with a mic for Comedy Central. Though I was a comic who thought he was on a journey of edgy comedy. And there I was. I took a gig. Short attention span theater. They sent me up there. Man with a mic. That's where the amazing interaction with Jonathan Winters happened the first time, when I went up to him and crazy Dick Cavett was wandering around. And he saw I was about to interview Jonathan. So he took my sound guy's headphones and they sent me out with a question. I walk up to Jonathan and I was like, hey, Mr. Winters, are you enjoying the festival? Have you seen any comics that young comics that you were impressed with? He's like, nah, I haven't gotten out of the room. My wife is sick back at the hotel room. And I said, oh, Jesus, I'm sorry. Sorry to hear that. Sorry you're going through that, Mr. Winters. He said, yeah, I should never put her in air cargo. And I turn around and Cavett is cackling. You ever seen a cackling Cavett? It's something. It's something. But I've been going up there for years. For better, for worse. And for some reason, it was putting a zap on my brain. Like, there's something about me, even with interviewing people, doing this show, doing what I do, that if I don't do it for a week or two, I feel like I don't know how to do it. My brain just does that. And I drift and I go, and wherever the hell my brain goes, most of what I experience is what my head is generating. A lot of it's not great. A lot of obstacles in my head. And then the first night I was there, the first day, the first show, the place I played seated like 120 people. It was just great. I had Lara Bites open for me. She did like 10, 12 the first night. And then Allie Colbert, I'd seen her on TikTok or a reel or something. And I ran into her up there and I just said, do you want to do some time before me? She was great. And I enjoyed the shows and I was happy that the people that got tickets. Listen to me, Connie. I had fun. I had fun and I did great shows. And the people there really enjoyed it. And I was glad I did them for the people that came out. I'm very good at comedy. Yeah, I'm not. I don't think I have to tell you guys that. But I need to tell Connie that again and again. Connie, listen to me. I'm fucking amazing. Don't you guys know that paired with the utter insecurity and fucking psychic turmoil that goes on? Can't you hear a guy that's drowning in himself? Don't you know what's going on, Connie? Come on. So the gala that I was so concerned about, I went over to that theater. Here was the good thing, and this is just shop talk, I guess. But in years past, they shot it at a place that must have seated between 3,000 and 4,000 people, and it was impossible to have a good show. So I was haunted by that. And thinking that I had to host an evening of that was like kind of daunting, but I was like, I had it coming. That's how I saw this gala. I booked it 2.5 years ago. It would have been special and important a decade ago or more, but now it was like, all right, I'll do it. It's not going to change anything. I'm not going to, you know, I appreciate the opportunity. I had it coming, though. But I went over to see Patton, who was hosting it the night before me, and it was half the size. It was a 1,200-seater. And most of us have played 1,200-seaters. And I was talking to Patton for a while, and I went out on the stage, and like, there's just some part of me that lives out there. And for some reason, if I get off of that stage for a week or two, I forget that I live up there, that there's a mark that lives up there. And I got on stage, an empty stage the night before, and I was like, oh, fuck yeah, this is going to be fine. Laid out my set the next night, did the run through, did the rehearsals. I had not done the job of hosting in a while, where you got to be sort of gracious and keep the flow going and ride that line. But a lot of people there came to see me, and I did a lot of the material that, you know, I don't think I'll be doing on the special. And also talking about Canada, because it's going to be my future residence, hopefully, if the paperwork clears. And, you know, I got to get it in. I'm almost done with it. But I want to have the option. I'd like to have some kind of permanent residence situation up there. It all rolls off me up there. As soon as I get up there, no matter what city or town, over the last year, I've been to a lot of them. I just relax. I feel better. I like the pace. I like the people. The food is fucking great. I'm like ready. And by the time the stuff processes, you know, it'll probably be a few years from now. And, you know, I might be, you know, if everything hasn't burned up down here, it might be nice to spend half the time in the beautiful country of Canada. Because you know why. You know why. So now I talk to Neil Gaiman about Sandman, about music, about other stuff. I tell him my experience with him. It's good. 10 episodes of The Sandman begin streaming on Netflix this Friday, August 5th. This is me and Neil Gaiman. You want to wear those? Sometimes they help.
Yep. It was nice for knowing what your voice is doing.
It is, right?
When I was starting out
as
a young journalist, young writer, I guess, getting interviewed, and people would ask me to wear headphones, it would drive me mad. I'd have to get one thing off and it was listening to my voice. But somewhere in there doing audiobooks, I got over the sound of my voice. It no longer cringe and stuff, and I can just think of it as a musical instrument.
Yeah.
And I know what it's doing.
Yeah.
And so I love the headphones because I can do different things going, oh, this is exactly what it's doing.
And
you don't play, you're playing the instrument less approximately.
Yeah.
You can get more precise.
That's right. And when you're doing audiobooks, that's hours.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you're going to be doing it for 3 days.
Yeah. And you have a director there who's telling you, like, you know, do another read on that.
Yep.
Do you do voices when you do audiobooks?
Yeah, always.
You do like all different characters?
Yeah.
That's great.
That's the, where would be the fun if you didn't do that?
I don't know. It depends what kind of book it is. You know, when I was reading my memoir, it was really just me, different variations of me. Sometimes I'd be like, ah, you know, and other times like, yeah.
You know, the weirdest one for me, the only time I still look back and go, did I do the right thing?
Yeah.
I have no fucking clue.
Yeah.
Is I did a collection of my nonfiction called The View from the Cheap Seats.
Yeah.
And that one is all fine, except it contains in it two interviews. One with Stephen King.
Yeah.
An article about Stephen King that contains an interview.
Yeah.
And an article about Lou Reed that contains an interview with Lou.
Yeah.
And so for both of them, I'm like, do I try and do a Lou? Do I try and do a Steve? And at the time I was just like, yeah, I'm going to go for it.
You did?
It's the only thing I've never dared go back and listen to. It could be awful. It could be fine.
You did Lou.
But it was just like going, you know, trying to get that, kind of Lou.
Slightly nasally, isn't he?
Slightly nasal, slightly
deadpan.
Very, very New York.
Yeah, right.
And just try and get that Lou voice in there, you know.
You interviewed him?
I did.
That must have been, I'm a huge fan of Lou's, and I tell a story about meeting Lou Reed and how I was online at a record store and I just really wanted to ask a question that would resonate. You know, I was in college, and I think I waited. The guy in front of me was wearing a white jumpsuit, and he had an amp strapped to his back, and he was playing guitar. And I was like, why this guy? So, but I get to Lou, and I just say, Lou,
what gauge pick do you use? You know, like mm-hmm. that would really connect. And he said, medium, man, got to use a medium. And that was it, the big moment.
But you know what? I love that.
Yeah.
I really love that because you gave him something that he could answer.
Yeah.
You didn't fuck it up.
Yeah.
And it's so, I mean, I get people in lines. I don't do a lot of signings anymore just because they go too long and I can't cope. But the saddest thing in the world is when the person gets to the front of the line in front of you and they've been there for 5-6 hours.
Yeah.
And in their head, they've been going, I've got my question. I've got my question. It's going to impress him. I'll say my question and then we'll be best friends. I've got my question and it's obscure. Nobody's ever asked this question before. Right. Well, I'm going to ask this question. And they get to the front and their question has now become the most important thing in the world for them.
Yeah.
And they can't even get it out. Uh-huh. Or when they do answer it, you give them the wrong answer or whatever. And it's just like this.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, why didn't you just get to the front of the line and say, hey, I love your books? And I could have said, thank you.
Were they shaking? Sometimes they're shaking. They're
sometimes
nervous.
They shake. Sometimes they faint. It's all
do
great.
They? You get fainters?
I've had a few faints. Not a
lot. I can't imagine what the... Well, first, let's talk about Lou. So what year was that?
Lou, I interviewed in about 1990, maybe 91. And I then met him for dinner in 92 or 93.
And what are your feelings about the Velvet Underground?
I think the Velvet Underground are the most important band that America produced in the 1960s, full stop.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm agreeing. I'll agree with you. I interviewed Jerry Harrison yesterday, and we talked for like 30 minutes about Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers.
Who wouldn't have existed without... I mean,
exactly.
You know, Jonathan Richman talks about essentially the scales lifting from his eyes and hearing the first Velvet Underground album and then going to whatever it was, 60 different Velvet Underground gigs in Boston where they were playing.
Yeah, as a kid.
Yeah.
I think it soothed him. I think that the layers of sound that the Velvet Underground created was like just perfect for his brain.
I think they were... The Velvets for me are like a sort of resonance test.
They're
like, they're like when somebody walks over to a piano key and they hit it hard and the other keys resonate and all of the other G strings in the room resonate and nothing else does.
Yeah.
And for me, that's the Velvets. It's like the people who resonate to the Velvets, they heard that and they resonated.
Right.
And everybody else heard nothing at all and it might not have existed.
And then without them, you don't get like Brian Eno even. Like later Brian Eno.
And you don't get David Bowie. There was stuff that Bowie stole from the Velvets that was so important to, you know, it's the stuff that gets you from the man who sold the world to Hunky Dory and Ziggy and everything after.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I listen to them all the time still. I can't stop, really. You?
Me too. Absolutely.
Which albums?
All four. And I have a very, very soft spot for Loaded.
Me too.
And Fully Loaded.
Me too.
And I feel was unfairly written off.
Yeah, Sweet Nothing is one of the best.
Absolutely.
Oh my God.
I just love, I will go and listen to that album and just put it on in the background and there's Dougie Yule singing Who Loves the Sun everything is perfect.
It's great. So are you a musician?
No.
Never in a band or anything?
I'm as a 61-year-old English person, of course, I was a punk in late 76, early 77. So, of course, I was in a band.
Didn't require musicianship.
There are photos of me and my band back then. And I'm really pleased having, you know, married a performer.
Yeah.
And got to see enough backstage areas and enough buses and enough gigs over the years. I'm so glad that I didn't go into that life and become that thing.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's...
Didn't quite have the talent, but it's like so good that I didn't spend that.
I love the backstage time, that moment before I go on stage doing stand-up. Like, to me, when you're just standing there, or if you're doing a TV show, that's a great thing about show business. If you're backstage and all of a sudden someone walks a horse through for the next piece, you're like, this is show business.
I love that about being on... late night interview shows, more than anything else in the world, the point where, you know, all of a sudden Paris Hilton trips over you on her way out. And you're sort of going, I just, dear, I just tripped up Paris Hilton. Exactly. And you're kind of apologizing.
Yeah. And you see them and they're like kind of real people.
Yeah.
And they have this, that moment of vulnerability of a regular person. And you're like.
And they're approximately real people. I remember being on a early morning.
Yeah.
News TV show in New York in
1995.
Yeah, local 1995 or 1996 in New York. Yeah. And to talk about a book. And I'm standing there and somebody is standing in front of me.
Yeah.
And he looks vaguely familiar.
Yeah.
And I tap Dave McKean and say, that guy, who is he?
Yeah.
And Dave says, I don't know. And then he walks in and sits down and suddenly he's in front of the camera.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, I know you. You starred in A Clockwork Orange. Malcolm McDowell.
Do you know him now?
I don't.
Yeah.
But I just loved the fact that I didn't recognize him when he was a human being.
Just a person. Yeah.
He was just a person standing, but a vaguely familiar one. And the moment he's in front of the camera and I'm looking at him on the screen backstage.
That makes sense. Yeah. So I have to ask you questions and I have to tell you exactly where I'm at with Sandman. I'm not a big comic book guy. I didn't grow up that way. And I'm almost like your age, right? So, but for some reason, in the late 80s, I'd spent time out here, you know, starting in comedy and getting, you know, fucked up on drugs. And I went back to Boston to kind of reconfigure myself. And I had a mild cocaine psychosis going on, all right? I was sober. And somehow or another, I started with Hellblazer at the first issue.
Yeah.
And being not a guy that had a vocabulary or a context for comics in general, Hellblazer for me in that state of mind sort of made sense. I was like, this is real.
Yep.
And this is possible. And this guy's in between worlds. And that's how I felt I was. So through Hellblazer, I get Sandman. So that's where it starts for me. At the first issue, and I go through like, you know, 20 or 30 of them or 40 of them even. I think I went up and dug up my old comics and I have a lot of them. I don't know where I have the death one, the first graphic novel, but it was all something not just soothing in an entertainment way, because I don't know how to take fantasy in as entertainment as well as somebody who is sort of a fantasy nerd, but I needed it to make sense of the world. And I wonder, I imagine that's in some ways how most fans of it are, right?
I think most people use fiction to make sense of the world.
Yeah.
They use stories to make sense of the world.
Sure.
And I think sometimes fantasy allows you to process things that are happening and process information in ways that... I think sometimes it's just like an oyster and a pearl.
Yeah.
You're getting to cover it in a shiny layer of something that's actually going to make it hurt you less.
Sure.
And sometimes it actually gives you a way of thinking that you didn't have before. So an example of that would be the character of Death.
Right.
And when I created Death, I thought, you know, I just want a Death that I would like to meet.
Yeah.
When I get hit by that car, somebody who'll be standing there saying, yeah, someone will say, you know, you really should have looked both ways before crossing that street. Hi. Okay. We're going to move on to the next thing. And also there's a
reprimand, because the character that evolved was somebody said, well, it's your time. There was not judgment. Is there judgment?
I don't think there's judgment, but I think there's a certain amount of practicality. And she's a grown-up.
Yeah.
And I thought, I like that. Just a Death that I'd like to meet. And over the years, probably the biggest responsibility that I feel like I have from having been a writer in my life, the number of people who've come up to me and said, you know, your Sandman comic, it got me through the death of my son. It got me through the death of my mother or my lover or my uncle or my friend.
Hmm.
And the idea of thinking of your death being with them at the end let me cope.
Mm.
And that doesn't mean that the person believes that what I wrote was true.
Right.
It means that it gave them a way of seeing things that let them hold on and made things easier for them.
Yeah. That's a powerful feeling to to receive that from somebody and then to be gracious about it and really know that was not necessarily your intention, but it's a beautiful kind of result of what your work is.
Absolutely. And it would never have occurred to me
right.
that would have been the result and that I would have now, you know, 3 decades of that. I got to take Kirby Hall-Baptiste, who is in plays Death in the Sandman yes. TV show, aside yeah. at San Diego a couple of days ago. And I said, look, this is kind of a bit more serious than the normal conversation that you're going to have with somebody at the convention as yeah. an actress. But I have to tell you, this is what I've been doing for the last 30 years. People have been coming up and saying this to me. And I guess you need to know, as this character, that probably for the rest of your life, people will come up to you and they will tell you about the deaths of people who were important to them and tell you that you or the character that you've played that they saw on television got them through something hard. And that's going to be a responsibility and you're going to have to kind of live up to it. And it is a gift that I give you. And I know you didn't ask for it
yeah.
because you just signed up to be an actress in a show. But you have this now too.
But the responsibility is to be present and receive, you know, what the gratitude.
That is exactly the responsibility. And I think Kirby is actually somebody who will be present
sure.
and will be there for them, which really, well, not, I've met a lot of actors. Not all of them would be.
Right.
Some of them would just be going, they would be mentally going, is this person talking about me? Mm. Can they do anything for my career? Are they telling me that I'm a wonderful actor? No? Then I will move on to the next place. Kirby, I think, will...
Sure.
Isn't that person and will carry that burden.
So, like, and tell me about, like, during the period where I was losing my mind a bit, it comes back, you know, once you clean up, it takes a couple years, but it comes back. But there seemed to be room in my mind at that time to, you know, indulge in the idea of practical magic
mm-hmm.
and of, you know, not getting deep into it because I really couldn't make sense of Crowley. And I know that references to Crowley and sort of Crowley himself, even in this new series of Sandman, or a guy based on Crowley, shows up.
Yep.
So... how deep did you get into Crowley?
Not very deep. I probably would have got deeper if I'd liked his prose style.
It's difficult.
I found his... I'm always impressed by, you know, Alan Moore and those guys
yeah.
who find something beautiful in it and get deep into it. I was repelled by the prose style.
And what are they, the Cantos? Or is that Ezra Pound?
Ezra Pound is... No, Ezra Pound I love. He was appalling. He was monstrous. He
yeah.
was terrible, terrible person. Yeah. But his writing was so good.
Right, but didn't Crowley write a series? There were numbered poems.
Oh,
there
yeah.
were pieces that were... They were impenetrable and to me.
I found lots of his stuff impenetrable. And I just found his whole writing style kind of clunky. But I loved the idea of him, and I loved the idea of creating a character who was one of those magicians based on loosely on Crowley. There were a whole load of them. There's one in the wonderful Night of the Demon movie.
I'm just looking up the guy that played your guy, Charles Dance.
Charles Dance was my guy.
What a great actor.
Isn't he marvelous?
Yeah. He's been around forever too, right?
He is, and he has that lovely sort of star quality thing of imbuing the part that he's playing with every other part that
yeah.
he's ever played.
Sure.
And
the whole history.
You know, and so you look at him and you go, ah, yes, you are that Lannister who is going to get it in the guts on the loo.
So the magic thing, though, you never bought in?
I never bought in, and I guess I never bought in because I'm a writer. And for me, and it's weird because I know a lot of writers who love that stuff and who have bought in all the way. And
they do the
love,
rituals.
I mean but for me, when I was about 22, 23,
yeah.
I was standing on a railway station platform on East Croydon Station in London, South London.
Yeah.
And I saw somebody holding a newspaper, and the headline was Werewolf Captured in Southend.
Yeah.
On the Sun newspaper. And my heart sank because I thought, oh, I don't want anybody to have captured a werewolf, because if they capture a werewolf, then werewolves become real.
Yeah.
And then I have to deal, then all of the imaginary werewolves that I could ever create are now subsumed into what an actual werewolf is. And it would make me really sad because I want the ability to imagine anything.
Yeah.
So I much preferred the idea of magical systems that I could invent. And if I would research magic, which I would from time to time, I'd research like a magpie.
Yeah.
I'd just be looking for the shiny bits. I go, oh, I like you. You're a good secret word. And oh, okay, you're how the you're how the Romans did this thing. Good.
Right.
I will use you because I can, you know, mash you into this little bit of Kabbalah that I also know. But it's much more as a much more as a convincer.
Right. So you're not a historian. You're somebody that sort of you know, takes this stuff in, figures out, like, you know, how it can be repurposed or suggested or open up a door to something else within the story you're telling.
Absolutely.
And then when you get to something like American Gods, you're just mashing them all in.
People would say to me, how did you do the research for American Gods? And I said, I read everything I could for 40 years.
Brought them all. You summoned them all.
It was all there.
But I mean, how deep do you, like, you know, what is it? Is it just to inform your story, or do you do you do the same type of investigations that, you know, Joseph Campbell does? Or do you just read Joseph Campbell?
Oh, I tend not to read Joseph. If ever I can, I will go for primary sources.
Yeah.
Because primary sources are always much more interesting. It's much more interesting to read the Edda, the poetic Edda and the prose Edda, than it is to go and read the ways that other people have retold the stories.
So no Golden Bough.
No, I actually have the giant Fraser Golden Bough, the 13 volume one, I have not read it all, but every now and then I pick it up and read some of it with enormous delight.
Yeah.
I love that it exists. It's the same for things like the White Goddess.
Yeah, the White Goddess,
I love that they're there.
Yeah.
And I love... they don't have to be right, and they don't even have to be wrong. They just have to exist.
Yeah.
And people had to write them, so, and I love that.
In some way, you're involved in the same project, only yours is fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that there's quite as fine a line between fiction and fact on that stuff.
Uh-huh.
Because the truth is, one of the things that I've learned as a writer of fiction is when you start making things up.
Yeah.
Because human beings are designed to find patterns in things. We are pattern making and pattern discovering animals.
Mm.
The universe will start providing you with things that back up your pattern. So I will come up with a fictional scenario set in the past or whatever, I will then start finding evidence that this thing is absolute and absolutely true here, and I've got this, and this will back it up. And I have to sometimes remind myself that I don't actually believe this.
Right.
I've just
really
realized that this is my story. And look, here's another piece of evidence for my story, and this is another piece of evidence for my story.
In terms of, like, you mean when you set it in a year or place, that you find historical pieces that add to it that somehow justifies it as a truth for
absolutely bit. You can start coming up with a historical fiction and the facts will start marching to get into line, and it actually makes me incredibly sympathetic for anybody who has any kind of conspiracy theory,
of course, because
I realized if you have a conspiracy theory, the facts will just march and they'll get into line, and all of a sudden, you know, you'll discover that, well, this person was at the same school as this person, so they must have done this thing.
It means nothing.
And it means absolutely nothing.
The brain wants to make those connections.
Brains make patterns and brains find patterns.
And then if you attach belief to it, that's when the trouble starts.
Exactly.
It's like, it's real.
And you have to be able to go, it's real for certain given values of real, but...
Well, it can be real, like I was talking about with my brain, is that, you know, it can be real and then it has to just become provocative. Like, you know, you want to make it real, like a conspiracy theory, fine. But if you are able to, and I hope this catches on, you're able to take yourself out of it for a minute and say, well, there's really no fucking way that this, it can be this convenient. History doesn't work that way. But because I was thinking that way, it made me think about this in a different way.
Absolutely. And I think that's the important bit. I love that you discovered Sandman at a time when you need it.
Yeah. Well,
and I love that it gave you what you needed.
Sure.
At the time that you needed it. Because I think that really is the point of fantasy and the fantastic, is it gives you a little holiday from reality, but then it sends you back into reality to see it.
Haunted.
Yeah, but also seeing it from a different angle.
Yeah.
Seeing it anew, seeing something freshly that you're familiar with.
Well, yeah, especially if it's emotionally engaging, like Sandman is, and how you know, put all these characters together, but even, you know, watching the show. But you do get a feeling. It does make you feel. So then you go out into the world with that feeling, and then it takes however long it's going to take to shake that.
Yeah.
To seeing it through the lens of Sandman, right?
I love that. And I, you know, it's like when you get a really weird and really real dream and you wake up from it and your day is going to be colored by it. You know that. You,
yeah.
And on one level, you really know that you weren't just hunted by the KGB through Ireland for smuggling bunny rabbits, but that was what happened to you. And now you're going to have to go through the day and you're really sad because you did actually see your child who you, for some reason, never met in real life, shot in front of you, and that's going to color your whole day.
I had one last night that was very disturbing, and I had to stop myself from, you know, getting in touch with the guy that was in it.
Yeah.
You know, because I didn't want to bother him. But it was like, it stuck with me. I don't know how long it'll stay there. I hope it goes away soon.
They do stick, and I think that a good fantasy novel gives you that, and a good writer lends you their eyes to see through, and you just don't see the world in quite the same way for a little while, and that's got to be healthy.
Yeah, I guess so. As long as, like, again, you don't attach belief onto the fantasy and then, you know, start a cult.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think that's the weird thing now about, like, even in the world of comic inspired stuff or the business of comics, that there is sort of an almost slightly fascistic vibe to superhero fans.
I think there are various different groups of all of these people. It's that thing where you go to San Diego Comic Con.
Never been.
It's a monstrous, awful thing, like a giant tumor, and at the same time, it's a magical, liberating Woodstock of the mind for all of these kids. And those two things. The fact that it's a monstrous commercial machine and it's a liberating thing can both be true.
Okay.
And they both are.
Yeah.
And somewhere buried deep in that is a tiny little comics convention.
Sure.
Which is still going on.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that there's still the comics thing happening.
Well, I guess I'm critical of, I don't know, I don't watch them, the superhero movies, because I don't really grow up with it. And I'm sure I would like them okay. I was in the Joker for a minute, and that got a lot of flack because I'm publicly sort of critical of Marvel movies, and I did a DC movie, and I had to pay the price for that a little bit. But it is kind of bizarre to me how aggressive and how hostile and how possessive and weird that fan base can get. It seems almost like a religion a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I, you know, the weird thing about Sandman is I didn't have to deal with those guys very much over the last three decades because Sandman demanded a certain level of literacy and a certain, and it wasn't really a pre-adolescent power fantasy.
No.
So that's where they get captured. They get sort of stuck in early, you know, pre-adolescence, and it matters so much to them. I remember a guy comics fan who's dead now.
Yeah.
Talking to him once, and he was complaining about a writer-artist named John Byrne changing Superman's origin story. And this is, you know, we're talking 30-something years ago now. But he said to me, you know, he said, John Byrne did all the stuff, and it just destroyed my life. And I said to him, well, why did it destroy your life? Is it because you were the world's number one Superman expert and now you're not? Or what is it? And he said, well, it's a bit that, but it's much more that he brought back Superman's, Clark Kent's mom and dad, and they're dead in the comics. And my mom and dad are both dead, and I can't bring them back. Wow. And I suddenly thought, oh, you've been using Superman all your life as a way of holding on to reality and holding on to the world and using it for order. And the fact that you knew all of this stuff was what gave you protection against the world. And now something fundamental has changed and it's hitting you in an incredibly basic way.
Yeah.
And that sort of gives me an enormous amount of sympathy sometimes for these people who just get over invested and angry and upset. And you go, look, you're somebody who's been using, whether it's Iron Man continuity or Superman continuity or whatever, to hold on to and understand the world. And now something is somehow threatening the thing that you thought that you knew. And you have to try and fight back. And you just want to tell everybody that you can't bring your own parents back from the dead.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, that does put a different frame on it. But it seems to me that most of these superheroes are retooled, you know, generationally.
They're always retooled generationally.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's their strength.
Like Alan Moore, what did he do to Swamp Thing? He changed the whole thing, didn't he?
Absolutely. And he, you know, I think Alan Moore's Swamp Thing retooling was where it started for me.
Yeah.
As comics, just going, oh my gosh, you can, I remember reading them and suddenly going, oh, that thing that I thought that you could do when I was a teenager that I then thought you couldn't do, where you make comics that are as important and as literate and as smart as anything on the stage, anything on television, anything in the cinema, anything in a novel, you can do that because this guy is doing it.
Yeah.
And that for me was absolutely a revelation.
That was the gateway.
It really was.
But I didn't realize until today, really, that Sandman was sort of a retooling.
Well, what was lovely about Sandman was all I took was the name.
Yeah.
There was a Sandman, was one of the very first DC Comics characters in 1939.
Really?
In this guy in a gas mask putting superheroes to sleep.
Uh-huh.
And then in the early 1970s.
So he was a villain?
No, he would put bad guys to sleep.
Oh, bad
and
guys,
leave a calling card on them saying the Sandman.
An anesthesiologist.
Been... Exactly. Yeah, he had his gas gun.
Okay,
he had his gas mask. He wore a trench coat and a hat. And then in the 1970s, Joe Simon and Jack Kirby created the Sandman. And this was a sort of goofy children's superhero who lived in dreams and would battle the lobster men from Pluto and
Protect them during their dreams.
Yeah. It was silly and funny.
Yeah.
And it lasted about six issues. And that one I never forgot. And I always thought, I felt like the idea of somebody who lives in dreams was never properly exploited.
Mm.
So when I was asked by DC Comics if I would come up with a monthly comic, the idea of taking the name, the Sandman, and making somebody who lived in dreams. And also, I was young.
Yeah.
I'd published a handful of short stories.
Before.
You were
a writer, though.
I was a writer, but I was a primarily nonfiction writer. And I didn't know if I could do a story every month.
Well, were you a comic book kid?
I'd been a comic book kid, absolutely. And then I'd been sort of a comic book kid until I was like 17. And then suddenly I wasn't interested in what comics had for me. and I walked away.
Was that the punk rock time?
That was the punk rock time. And
different concerns? Did you become political? Did you become like nihilistic? What?
I just didn't think that there was anything. The things that had interested me about comics didn't seem to be there anymore, and I had no patience for superheroes even then.
Where'd you grow up?
Sussex in England.
And like, how many sisters and brothers?
Two younger sisters. I was the oldest.
And what was your parents' thing?
My parents' thing was mostly Scientology when I was growing up. That was their thing.
Now, they must have been early adapters. I mean,
they were.
It must have been the first wave in British Scientology.
They were the first wave. So that was their thing.
So were you able to become fascinated with that? Or did you just see it as this weird thing your parents were doing?
I think what it gave me, I think that what was great for me looking back on it,
yeah.
I don't think I knew this at the time, was I'm going to a high Church of England school, very religious but Christian school. I'm a Jewish kid studying for my bar mitzvah.
So they kept the Jewish thing going.
They definitely kept the Jewish thing going.
So they looked at it as more of a self-help thing?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And there's Scientology going on in the home, and I'm like, it gave me a wonderful sort of vantage point going, people believe all of these different things. People, okay, but I don't have to believe any of this because I can be over here and not believe that. I can be over here and not believe that, which means that, you know, it's kind of like the thing with where you start talking to people about what gods they believe in.
Sure.
And you go, you know, isn't it amazing that you don't believe in all of these gods and they don't believe in all of those gods, but somehow out of all of the millions of gods human beings have come up with that didn't exist, you found the one that did.
Yeah.
And so for me, it was, it kind of gave me this kind of anarchy of belief.
One canceled out the other, and you were able to, not canceled out, but you were able to see belief as a choice in a way, or an action, as opposed to, you know, there's one only thing.
Absolutely. If I was going to believe in anything, I was going to believe in Harlan Ellison short stories.
Harlan Ellison.
I was going to believe.
So you're already reading that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing about, I don't know if it was apparent at that time if the approach to Scientology was not as expansive and I don't know if there was tithing then or how organized the church was. But I mean, as it became more established, the mythology within it is definitely science fiction shit.
Absolutely.
Was that there then?
It was, but what I liked best about that was just the idea of a lot of people who didn't seem to think that being a science fiction writer was a failure as a profession.
No, he was the guy.
You know, and I thought, okay, cool. So being a science fiction writer, and I think I was kind of disappointed when I grew up and I wasn't a science fiction writer.
So I was a fantasy writer. You saw that the science fiction writer could be, you know, could create a religion.
I definitely got to the point of going, it's a good thing to be a science fiction writer. It's a good thing. It's a good thing to be a writer. It's fiction. Seems safe.
Did you read Hubbard's books?
I read some of them and liked some of the early science fiction stuff.
You did, yeah.
But I loved reading. There was a book called Death's Deputy that I enjoyed,
uh-huh.
and a book called Fear
uh-huh.
that I really enjoyed.
And they stayed in the church throughout your life?
Yeah.
Huh. So the church grew around them?
Yes. I mean, they were there.
Yeah. Interesting.
But I think for me...
Your sibling Scientologist?
Yes.
Mm.
But I think for me, what was really interesting was just having all of the access even as a really small kid to fantasy novels and science fiction novels. Yeah. They were always around the house.
Sure.
I'm still not sure, looking back on it, quite who was reading them.
Yeah.
Because I don't think my dad was ever a big science fiction reader.
Yeah.
And I know my mum never read science fiction, and it certainly wasn't my sister's. So they must have sort of come through with people leaving them there.
Yeah.
But... it's like when I was about 7, there was a box of comics, American comics, that was left in the house.
Yeah.
And I remember discovering for the first time the Justice League of America
yeah.
and Green Lantern and Brave and the Bold comics and all of this kind of stuff. And for years, it's baffled me. Where did they come from? Who left this giant box of American comics? And the last conversation I had with my dad before he died, I was saying there was this box of comics. He said, oh, yeah, I know where that came from. I will tell you. And then he died.
Stop it.
No, it's true. he did. And I never found out where that box of comics
came from. How long ago was that?
That was 2009.
So not too long ago.
Not too long
ago. Now, so... why don't more, you know, how come there's not more weird Jewish shit in the stories?
There's a certain amount of weird Jewish shit.
Yeah.
I like to think of myself as being somebody who has weird Jewish shit in the stories.
Yeah.
My favorite is...
I don't know them well enough to maybe make that statement, but maybe you could tell me, lead me to some.
Well, for example, a lot of the stuff that I tend to put in is, I think, point of view.
Yeah.
Looking at something like Good Omens,
yeah,
where I think of Crowley, the demon,
yeah,
as incredibly Jewish.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, he just wants answers from God. He thinks that there's so much stuff in the world that doesn't make sense. Yeah, he's a demon because he asked questions,
sure,
because he hung around with the wrong people.
Sure.
He would still like answers.
Right.
And he's questioning God. He's arguing with God. He's wrestling with God.
That's the great Jewish tradition.
And that, for me, is who Crowley is. And
okay,
that, for me, is one of the giant... The engine that runs and drives,
yeah,
Good Omens... is Aziraphale, the angel who fundamentally is convinced that God probably knows what God is doing, so you must leave God's plan alone.
And sure,
you may have to fix things if it looks like it's going to hurt people, but
yeah,
but he's very sure that heaven is on the side of good.
Yeah.
And then you got Crowley, who's just like, I think it's all screwed. It doesn't,
yeah,
make sense.
Yeah,
explain,
yeah,
this stuff. Why,
yeah,
would,
yeah,
why would any, yeah, why would any sane deity organize,
right,
things?
He's
like
improvising.
This? Exactly. So that, for me, is fundamentally incredibly Jewish.
And you were conscious of that when you created it and when you were
absolutely
doing it.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But then, you know, there are things like, you know, the old Jew saying the Shema before he dies
in the series.
In the series.
That's a beautiful scene. I think that's the first death that,
yeah,
that you see, because that's a heavy episode. There's a couple episodes that really kind of got me in because I watched all of them, and, you know, having read the comic years ago, and my feelings about who Sandman was to me and who the character was in the comics, it was faded enough to where, you know, I could see that the guy fit the framework, and he, you know, it looked like the comics. And my girlfriend, who's younger than me, is like a huge Neil Gaiman fan. So she brought me a bag of things. Like, she's got, you know, you defined her adolescence. And maybe she'll be here when you leave, and it'll be a big day. But going into the series, the first couple episodes, I'm like, all right, I get this from the comics. I don't know that, and I understand where we're at. But the diner scene with Thulis, and that character I don't think's in the comics, is he?
He is, but he looks kind of, in the comics, he looks shriveled and,
oh, really?
Skeletal and weird.
So that whole story with the mother and that's all directly from the comics?
It's all from the comics.
Well, that scene in the diner, in terms of, see, I need, one of the reasons I'm fantasy adverse is I need a human entry point that functions as emotional in a human way.
Yeah.
So that whole thing, you know, that got me in to the series. It was, you know, those interactions, the truth thing, telling the truth and where it goes. And then, you know, by the time we get to death, making her rounds, all that stuff is, my humanity's open and it functions as something beautiful and devastating. But yeah.
That was the way that I hoped it would work.
Mm.
Episode 5 in the diner is grueling. It's really hard.
Yeah.
It's not comforting. Awful things happen to people that you love.
But it's the struggle of humanity.
Absolutely.
In a practical way.
It's about being human.
Right.
And it's these people, and it gives you a story that you can hold on to, go through. It's going to leave you a little shaken.
Mm.
But then I feel like we give you episode 6. We give you death, and we give you Hob and Morpheus meeting in the pub every 100 years. And
yeah,
they're healing. And they're both in their own way about connection.
Right,
and
right.
Just that, about the world working and the world continuing.
Those are the episodes that ground it in the world in a way, like in day-to-day stuff. And, you know, once I'm able to sort of suspend my disbelief in terms of just walking through these, you know, these landscapes, you know, that are, you know, when you have the dream world and you just, you know, sort of like, I'm building dreams towards the end, you know, you want to come see what I'm working on. I'm like, all right, you know, I can do it. I can make the jump. Yep. Only because it's grounded so strong in his relationship with the waking world.
If, you know, for me, I like using fantasy to talk about things that matter to me and talk about the world that we're in. That's just the way that I use it. I don't think I could go and write a Tolkien-esque fantasy where we're completely in another world.
You couldn't.
I don't think I have the engines. I hugely admire what George R. R. Martin did in Game of Thrones, because for me, if I wanted to do that thing, I'd probably set it much more on Earth, and I think it would have been much more of a mistake to have done. I love what he did, and I love the way that it works. But for me, a lot of what matters in fantasy is just who we are, shining a light onto us, giving us something to hold on to. And that was important for me in American Gods. It was important in Neverwhere or The Graveyard Book. And it was important, incredibly important, all the way through Sandman.
When what stuck with you about the sort of childish Sandman character, you know, that's the one that stuck with you. And when you started to build Sandman, what were the priorities?
So the priorities for me were, I was going to have to come up with a story every month, because the comic was going to come out every month.
Yeah.
And I had no idea if I could write a story every month.
Yeah.
So I thought, okay, what I need to do is create some kind of template that will allow me to do anything. So if I've got any kind of idea for a story, I can probably go and do it. If I have a strict kind of template, you know, it's the monster of the month or whatever.
Sure.
Then by episode 5, I'm going to be tired of monsters of the month and the whole thing is going to fall apart.
Sure.
So I need something that gives me something big. And the idea of the title character of Dream, of Morpheus, of the Sandman, being an entity as old as the universe, being something that is in everybody's dreams, I thought, it gives me historical,
yeah.
It gives me fantasy, it gives me horror, it gives me science fiction if I wanted to go there. It gives me all of this kind of, gives me so much stuff to go into.
Sure. And anything.
Basically, it's a story machine.
He's been there forever and he's in people's dreams.
So that gives me a way into story. And that was, for me, the most important thing, just the most important thing that I could hold on to. So you ask, what was in my head when I started creating? What was in my head right at the beginning was just,
how do I?
I got to write a story every month.
Right.
How do I do that?
Practical.
But what's lovely is once you start doing that and you start building, what I realized I was building was the foundation. And I could see the shape of the foundation, and that told me the shape that the building would be.
Sure.
So it allowed me to actually come up with, by the end of the first year.
Yeah.
So what I did was, I figured, okay, this comic will be like most comics where a minor critical success is also a major commercial failure.
Yeah.
So they'll cancel it about issue 8.
Yeah.
They'll probably give me a year because they tended at that time to give you a year. So I'll get the phone call at issue 8 saying you cancelled.
Yeah, four
and I'll
more.
Have four issues to sort of finish off with. I can do that. So I'll work out an 8-issue long storyline. So that's why the first issue of Sandman is 8 issues. It's because I figured I'd get the phone call there saying you're cancelled.
Yeah.
What came as a complete shock was when, at issue 8, we were selling more comics than anything like that had ever sold. And I thought, oh, I'm safe. I think I'm okay. They're not going to turn and cancel me.
And you saw it as something you could do with your life.
Yeah. I was like, okay, I'm going to get to finish the story I started, which I didn't think I was ever going to. You know, I built things in the beginning of Sandman that I knew would only pay off if I got to the end of the story in the way that I wanted it to go. But I didn't ever think I'd get there.
The real end of it? I mean, you know, how many episodes? 75. 75 issues?
Yep.
So you knew enough about the arc in the first 8 episodes that you saw your destination?
Absolutely. I didn't know how long it would take to get there. I figured I'd be there by about issue 30 and was absolutely wrong.
Oh, okay.
But I knew, you know, it's the equivalent of I'm in New York, I'm going to hitchhike to Los Angeles. I know where I am, and I have an idea of the kind of places I'm probably going to go on the way. But then you hitchhike, and sometimes you don't quite go to the place you thought you were going. And sometimes somebody that you meet on the way becomes incredibly important to you. But at the end of the day, you still have that journey. It just took you twice as long.
I get it. So, but when did you start? I mean, so right at the beginning, you knew that you were going to integrate, you know, it's mostly religious mythology, really, right?
It's all sorts. It's all, you know, I mean, what I love about Sandman is it's kind of a unified field theory of mythology and fantasy in that it's set in a universe in which everything is true.
Right.
And I remember doing a storyline called Season of Mists, and I thought, let me just see how far I can go with this. Mm. And I started bringing everybody onto the stage. And now I'm bringing the Greek gods and I brought the Norse gods on. Okay, how about if I bring on fairies? It's going to collapse if I bring on... Oh, okay, no, it's still... The plates are still spinning and I've got fairies. And now I'm going to bring on Chaos and Order from DC Comics, ripping off Michael Moorcock. Oh, yep, that's still working. Okay, what about angels? It's going to collapse if I bring on angels. No, it's still working. And it was a fascinating experience doing
that. So that's the process.
That was definitely the process of that show. Huh. That story.
And then you could bring them, and then, like, I mean, that must have led you to American Gods in some way.
I think in a lot of ways it did. By the time I'd finished Sandman, I was fascinated by the idea of new gods. Mm. And, you know, it wasn't original with me. People like Harlan Ellison and Roger Zelazny and various people had talked about the idea of gods and belief. But it was definitely a thing that by the time I finished Sandman, all of the stage was set for American Gods.
Yeah, and what do you think was that point? Why Sandman at that time did it take off like that? I mean, we talked a little bit about how it wasn't some pre-adolescent male fantasy. You know, it was the opposite. It was, you know, it was slightly sexualized. It was kind of feminine, but very masculine in a certain way.
What
unrepresented masculinity?
So one of the things, so year one of me doing Sandman, the people who showed up at signings were uniformly male.
Yeah.
They were uniformly aged between 15 and 23.
Yeah.
And they were the guys who were there in line to get their comic book signed.
Yeah.
By year two, I was going to comic conventions and large, sweaty guys, unshaven guys would spot me and they'd come over and they'd go, I got to shake your hand, man. You brought women into my store. No women had ever come into my comic book store and you bring women. You're the Sandman guy and you bring women into my store. Man, I got to shake your hand. And they, and by sort of year three, there were as many women as there were men in the signing lines. And what was also happening was that I think a lot of the times the guys have been trying to get their girlfriends into comics and failing.
Right.
And then they'd give them Sandman and the women would go, oh my gosh, there's something here and this is really interesting. And then when they'd split up, the girls would go off with the Sandmans and they'd give them to the new boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
So it was, Sandman was spreading sexually.
Oh, interesting.
Sexually transmitted comic.
Oh, that's amazing.
And you were getting that. And then a couple of years later, I go and do signings and I could no longer tell who was somebody's mother.
Who was someone's girlfriend?
Because actually, these people were all Sandman fans, and they weren't somebody there to get something signed for somebody else. And that thing of just having created an audience who hadn't existed before.
Mm. And did it eventually become more women?
No, I think it pretty much stuck 50-50.
Oh yeah,
The you know, Sandman readers, what we did was just expand the comics readership from people who had only been reading comics to people who were coming into stores to get their Sandman fix and with luck would discover Love and Rockets or, right. you know, 8-Ball or whatever.
Those were, that's where I went. I mean, that's, you know, I went, I always was sort of prone towards S. Quay Wilson and R. Crumb because that stuff is viscerally human to me and disgusting yep. and filthy and sexy. And yeah, but I like 8-Ball. I like Charles Burns a lot.
Oh, Charles Burns is brilliant.
Oh my God.
Many, many years ago, I was hired to do a film script based on Black Hole.
Oh, my God.
And I was collaborating with Roger Avery.
Yeah.
And who did Killing Zoe and Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
And we did a script, and I was so proud of it. And I got a phone call one day from Roger saying, hey, they've got this famous director on board to direct.
Yeah.
And I said, that's great. He said, no, it's not. He said, we'll be fired next week. And I said, really? He said, yeah, the director's come on board.
Yeah.
He's going to want lots of different drafts. He's going to fire us. But they used our draft to get him. And I said, oh, are you sure? Yeah. You're kind of cynical, Roger. Yeah, yeah. And then a week later, we were fired.
Did the movie ever get made? The
movie never got made. And it makes me kind of sad because I think we did a great script based on that graphic novel because I love Black Hole so much.
Oh, it's amazing.
You know, it's incredibly
it's a beautiful.
Powerful story.
The full series in a book is great too.
Yeah.
So like, okay. So once you get Sandman, you've built this fan base and is that when you start running the short stories and the novels, you know, is that?
So Good Omens was written with Terry Pratchett while I was doing Sandman. But having done that once, I never wanted to do that again because I would do occasional short stories and let them mount up. But once Sandman was over, that was when I published Neverwhere and Stardust, the first short story collection, Smoke and Mirrors.
Yeah.
And then rolled up my sleeves and did American Gods. And I loved that Sandman had given me that. And it also meant that I could go back to Sandman whenever I felt like, whenever I missed it, basically. So every few years, I'd go back and do another Sandman project.
Yeah, and what the guy who did the covers,
Dave McKean.
Dave McKean, and he also did Hellblazer, right? For a while,
He started out doing the Hellblazer covers.
Yeah,
And then he was doing Hellblazer and Sandman.
Right, that's why it was. That was probably the gateway for me.
Yeah,
because I was reading Hellblazer.
So many people came to Sandman because of Dave McKean's covers because they didn't look anything like anything else in the comic store.
And what do you have a relationship with the creator of Hellblazer?
Well, the creator of Hellblazer, I guess, was Jamie Delano, was writing it. And Jamie and I have been friends for years. And, of course, the original creators of John Constantine were... It was Alan Moore, Steve Bissett, and John Tottlebon.
In
Swamp Thing. And that came about because Steve and John really loved drawing Sting. And they'd started drawing Sting in the background of things. And they said to Alan, can we draw Sting some more? And that became...
Make him a character.
Exactly. So Alan wrote him in as this sort of basement level occultist.
Yeah. But like an occult detective.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I had enormous fun because in Sandman the comic, I got to do one John Constantine story, but also got to introduce you to his ancestor, Lady Joanna Constantine, from a few hundred years ago.
Mm.
And so in the TV show...
Oh, so that's that's a real character.
So that was why I went, well, we've got Joanna Constantine anyway back in the 18th century. Nobody coming to the TV show is necessarily meant to be familiar with anything else. We're kind of starting in our own universe.
I was, and I'm sort of like, is that supposed to be John? Did they replace John?
We replaced John with Joanna. That's because we were also going to do Joanna back in the French Revolution.
That's right, yeah.
And we're going to have some fun with that.
So that was interesting, the way you put the show together. What's been your experience with TV? Because a lot of people just sort of, writers especially, are kind of like, all right, you kind of get pushed out.
I've had really interesting experiences with TV. I my first experience was making the TV show of Neverwhere.
Yeah.
In the 1990s.
Yeah.
And just trying to do something that there wasn't a system in place to do in the UK at that time, mm-hmm. which was frustrating.
Yeah.
I wrote an episode of Babylon 5, which was enormously fun, and then came back and did more television with some Doctor Who episodes. And that was more educational than anything I can possibly say, because I wrote two episodes and was incredibly proud of both script.
Mm.
And I felt like one script made it to the screen,
yeah.
and that one won awards and everybody loved it.
Yeah.
And one script kind of got shot, but yeah. it wasn't done terribly well. It wasn't done in...
But you're part of history.
You're part of history, but I also yeah. looked at it and went, hang on, and you know, I should have been... I couldn't control anything
yeah,
in this.
Right.
Which meant that when Good Omens started happening at the BBC, I said, look, I think I actually need to be the showrunner on this. Not because I want to be a showrunner, because I really don't.
Yeah.
But because I want to look after this. And the only way that I know that I can look after it and
yeah.
stop other people cutting things I wouldn't have cut or yeah. casting people I wouldn't have cast is if I'm in charge. So I got to cast David Tennant and Michael Sheen.
Mm.
I got to make my show.
Yeah.
And because I'd made a show and got a lot of love and attention and eyes on it, that meant suddenly Warner Brothers looked at me for Sandman. And up until that point, they'd spent 30 years going, well, the writer of the original comics should be yeah. kept as far away from the property
sure.
as possible yeah. while people make movies or whatever, because what would a writer of the original comics go? And suddenly Warners are going, hang on, the unique selling point of the Sandman TV series would be Neil gets to oversee it and
yeah.
be in charge of it and make it the thing that he wants it to be. And suddenly I was in this world in which I got to make the Sandman that until that point would have been impossible. I'd watched so many bad Sandman movies fail to get made
yeah.
over the decades.
And just because you were just a writer.
Because I was just the writer. And also, I remember my first ever meeting.
Uh-huh.
It was probably about March 1990.
Yeah.
And I was out here in L.A. for a Sandman, and I was sent over to Burbank to the Warner's office
yeah.
and go in to see a president of Warner Pictures, and I'm asked, Neil, we've been, you know, there's a lot of interest in a Sandman movie.
Yeah.
What do you think? And I said, please don't make it. I'm just getting going with the comic.
Yeah.
It's just getting good. If somebody tries to make a movie now, it's going to throw everything off and it'll be really weird. And I remember the exec saying to me, very puzzled, she said, nobody's ever come into my office and asked me not to make a movie before. And I said, well, I am. And yeah. she said, okay, we won't make the movie. And so that gave me about six years of
relief.
So
that was based just on what? How many comics?
At that point, I was in Season of Mist, so we would have been around Sandman 20.
Really?
That
was bold.
Absolutely. But I knew what we were doing, and I wanted to be able to finish the comic that I'd started.
Wow. Yeah.
And then there were various other movies and good people trying to do this thing. The problem with the thing they were trying to do was they were trying to condense 2,000 pages of story
yeah.
into a two-hour movie. And you can't do it, because by the time you've thrown everything out that you need to make it a two-hour movie, it isn't Sandman anymore.
Well, that's what I was wondering when I was watching this. A couple of questions. How many seasons do you see?
As many as we can do to finish the story. I think it's very silly in this weird era we're in to be over-optimistic.
Of course.
So I...
Especially, were you Netflix?
I'm at Netflix, but I think I would have the same worry if I were at HBO right now, or even if I was at Amazon or whatever.
So you really don't know. It's sort of like when you first started writing the comic. You might have to figure out a way to wrap it up after season three.
Absolutely. What you get they press the button to let you do the next series when the first one has aired, and they've got the numbers in, and they go, yeah, okay, that's safe, and you can do another one now.
But this first 10 is exactly as you wanted them.
It really is. I'm so proud of it. And I think it's so... It's not like anything else on television.
I think that's true. And also I think that, you know, your casting choices were, you know, righteous. And it was clearly a decision.
Yeah.
So how did that go?
What it went was, we'd look at the original comic.
Mm.
And when each character would come on, we would say, okay, here is a character. Is there any reason why this character needs to be white? Is there any reason why this character needs to be male?
Mm.
A lot of the time, the answer was yes.
Mm-hmm.
Cain and Abel, they both need to be male. Actually, they wound up played by two actors, both of Indian descent.
They're great. Very funny.
But that was pure coincidence because they were the funniest and the best that sure. we auditioned. Yep. So we had them. That wasn't even righteous. That was just going for the brilliant ones.
And the Corinthian has to be the Corinthian.
The Corinthian has to be the Corinthian. So you look at things like that. But wherever we would get a character where it's like, okay, Lucien the librarian, what is important about Lucien?
Yeah.
What is important about Lucien is Lucien has been with Dream for over 10,000 years.
Oh, that's right. He was like an old man, wasn't he?
Lucien was the first raven. Yep. He was a tall, very tall man. And Lucien is a librarian.
Yeah.
Is there any reason why that character specifically has to be male? No. Mm. Is there any reason why that character specifically has to be white? No. Mm. Okay, that's good. Because what that does is double the number of people that we're going to audition for the role. It doesn't mean we won't audition white
sure.
male actors.
Right.
But what it means is we can get a lot more people in until we find the right person.
And that's the whole idea of it, is that the more voices, the better. You can get surprised.
That's the amazing thing. I mean, Viv Achyangpong is just amazing.
Great.
And she's wonderful. And she lands the part. And
yeah.
2 minutes in, she owns it.
Yeah.
And you know who she is. You know what she is. And that's yeah. amazing. With Death, which was a hard part to... The casting process was really weird.
Yeah.
The first one that we had to get right, if we didn't get it right, we didn't have a show, was Morpheus.
Yeah, I thought he was good.
He's amazing, and he lands it, and he came in the first email from the casting director. You know, she she'd done four auditions, she sent them over. Tom was the one from that we liked. And Tom then had to basically wait while we saw in the end, over 1,500 auditions
for
Morpheus.
No.
Yes. Because we wanted him, but we kept looking at other people.
Mm.
And then we were sure that we wanted him, but Netflix weren't quite convinced.
Uh-huh.
And then the pandemic happened.
Were they not quite convinced because they wanted a celebrity or a star? Or a name?
They would have loved a celebrity star name, but I think they also just weren't sure, and they also just weren't sure we'd found the best.
Mm.
So when the pandemic happened, they were like, oh, well, we're not shooting in May now. We won't shoot till November. So why don't you guys take another few months?
Yeah.
And you haven't looked at every actor in Australia yet. There are actors in...
They grow good actors in Australia.
They do. So we got all the Australians and we got... And at the end of the day, it was still Tom.
Mm.
Death was the other way around.
Yeah.
We had to cast Death correctly. We saw auditions from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of actresses who didn't land it for us. We had a few things that we needed to be sure of. We needed to love you.
Yeah.
We needed you to be able to talk to Dream as his big sister and tell him off, and we needed to believe that. And you had to be able to deliver the dialogue convincingly.
Huh.
We had supermodels auditioning. We had so many actresses of all possible skin tones and shapes and sizes.
So you're lucky you had the pandemic.
We really really went to town, and sure, it gave us so much extra time.
Yeah, and with Zoom, the sort of unfolding as the way of communicating, it's so much easier.
Oh my gosh, it is.
To make an appointment. No one's doing anything.
It was fabulous, and I think we got some amazing people just because they wanted to get out of the house.
Yeah.
And also, we got some amazing people because they were Sandman fans, was so lucky.
How are the fans going to react to Satan being a woman?
Given that the Lucifer in Sandman, when we see Lucifer naked, has absolutely nothing going on between their legs, I don't think people are going to have much problem.
And she's great.
Oh, she's amazing. Lucifer was based at the time visually on David Bowie, on young David Bowie,
right. Okay, I remember
as a
that.
Folk
yeah.
singer. When yeah. he had curly hair,
yeah.
he had a perm
yeah.
and an acoustic guitar.
I know. I did a movie that, I don't know if there's a movie called Stardust that I did.
Mm-hmm.
I got very up to speed on that Bowie.
So that early young Bowie was the one that I visually based Lucifer on. And so when we started, we were just going, okay, we want somebody who can do that.
Uh-huh.
And Gwendolyn Christie is 6'3". She is a human special effect anyway. You just look at her and she goes up.
I think she's great.
And I thought she can bring everything I need to that part. And then you give her wings, which take her up to about 7'6".
Yeah.
And then she towers over Tom Sturridge. And again, it was an idea of, okay, we need to find somebody who can go up against Tom that you would believe. And that casting, Boyd Holbrook as the Corinthian, again, we needed somebody who was in every way his opposite, who's much more easygoing. He's Southern. He's charming. Funny and lovely. And
That scene
he's also a monster who will eat your eyes.
Yeah. Exactly. But that scene at the serial convention, you know, where, you know, Sandman puts him in his place or he returns him or destroys him is, you know, it really is loaded up because of, what's the guy's name to Sandman? Tom?
Tom.
Because he is subtle. But when he needs to bring the hammer down, he can do it.
He really can.
In the face of anybody, in the face of Lucifer or the Corinthian.
I mean, one thing that I'm certain of right now, I have no idea whether or not Sandman is going to be, whether it's going to work or not. I know that I love it. I know that we made something that I'm proud of.
Well,
and that, honestly, is all I care about. Is I can hold my head up and go, I made a really good Sandman. So I don't know if it's going to be a huge success or not, but what I do know is that 24 hours after Sandman drops, Tom Sturridge will be a star.
Because
you can just see it. It's like people are going to go, what? There's this guy and he can do that?
Well, I think a lot of the acting, because of the sparsity of the world, you know, even when they're in the real world, that the sort of, when you say land a role in this context, I mean, they've got to own it, you know, in such a way that fills up the whole story in their moments.
Absolutely.
Like, even Despair, which had very little screen time, like just her physicality was genius.
That's a marvelous actress called Donna Preston.
Yeah.
And she, I'm in awe of what she does because you just look at her on screen and she's every sad, wet, lonely Sunday afternoon that you would probably kill yourself if you could just be bothered, but instead you're just going to sit here being completely miserable.
Oh my God. And then what was the device? Is that from the comics where she just sort of digs that hook into her face?
That was in the comics.
It's just interesting
how ring on.
Yeah, well, it's interesting the way she does it because it's almost like it's secondary.
Yeah.
You know, it's just in conversation. It's what she does, and then when you're watching it, you're like, oh, of course, that's what she does.
It's such a powerful performance.
And that kid Mason as Desire. That was
they brilliant?
Yeah, amazing. Very little screen time, but just owns the whole fucking thing.
Mason got cast through Twitter.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Mason tweeted me. Mason was in Cowboy Bebop.
Uh-huh.
And while waiting to be filmed in Cowboy Bebop, which was shooting in New Zealand, they were in managed isolation quarantine. So, which basically, and I've done it, they put you in a hotel room for 2 weeks and they let you out 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
So I think Mason was going out of their mind and looking online and loved Desire and actually had a Desire tattoo, which they showed me on Saturday. And so just sent me a tweet saying, have you cast Desire yet? And who's your casting agent?
Yeah.
And I thought, there's something about this tweet that is not just a fan.
Yeah.
There's something interesting about this. Yeah. And I looked at Mason, went to their webpage, looked at a few videos of them acting and performing in Hedwig and things, and thought, oh, you're really good. And just dropped a note to Alan Heinberg, the showrunner, to say, Alan, I think I may have found Desire. And just tweeted back and said, you want Lucinda Sison, who's our casting director?
Uh-huh. And that's how it happened.
And that's how it happened.
And then you got the real Hedwig in there, too. You got John Cameron Mitchell in there.
Oh, he's such a genius.
Great. He's great. You know, he's great. And, you know, you've hidden Mark Hamill in a pumpkin head, which is nice. That's a nice Easter egg in general, kind of.
I think it's always a great... And I love that we've got scenes with Matthew the Raven...
Patton, I know Patton.
Putting Patton in context here.
Yeah.
The first time I was aware of meeting Patton.
Yeah.
It was about 2000, and I was doing a signing.
Sure.
At the Stinking Rose restaurant and a reading.
In San Francisco?
In LA.
Oh.
However, the first talking to Patton, I discovered the first time I met Patton.
Yeah.
Was in 1992.
In Baltimore? No.
San Francisco.
Oh, right, yeah.
I was doing a signing at Comics Experience
for
Season of Mists in hardback, and Patton stood in line for 3 hours to get his copy of Season of Mists signed.
That's when I knew him. I lived in San Francisco. We were both comics. We both got to San Francisco at the same time, and he's a real comic nerd.
He really is. So he got his comic signed by me back then. And so for him, getting to play Matthew the Raven is the biggest dream come possibly true.
It's so funny. Is Matthew what's the backstory? Kit, my partner was saying it was based and rooted in Swamp Thing.
It's rooted in Swamp Thing. It was the idea of Matt Cable, Matthew Cable, who had died in Swamp Thing, killed essentially drunk driving and then spent a while in hospital. And I loved the idea, because I was perverse, that I would never actually say that in Sandman.
Yeah.
But you learn that he died drunk driving. You know his name is Matthew. So you know he did some bad things. So people put it together.
I think that if when you do another series, this is just a suggestion. Just my only note is make Patton do the crow noise, too.
I think, you know, anything that we can do just to make things harder on both Mark Hamill and Patton,
make them
work a little more, I think we should do that.
No, I thought it was all great. And I mean, all the acting, Thewis was amazing, and all the supporting parts were great. And, you know, once I got into it, it's a challenging thing to do that world. You know, because it's its own world, and you have it engaging with the world that we live in. But even that is a special place.
Well, it's also a thing that we do in there where each episode is different.
Oh,
and
for sure,
that is not a thing that you normally see on television. If you look at something like Game of Thrones,
right?
If you like Game of Thrones, the next episode of Game of Thrones is going to be a lot like that last episode that you liked. The same sort of stuff is going to happen.
Soap operatic.
It's going to be, you know, there's going to be some fighting some breasting, and there's going to be some betrayals and big thing. And that's what it is. And that's what it does episode to episode. Sandman is going to reinvent itself. It's like a movie, and it's still the same story. But you could be in an urban horror story one episode. You could be in high fantasy the next episode. You could be in something approaching a gentle, sentimental story about life.
Right.
Next episode.
But the thread is serving this grand arc of 75 issues, and you have to make these decisions about how to make 10 and then another 10.
Exactly. And then hopefully another 10 and then hopefully another 10.
And then that's it.
Maybe another 10 after that.
Well, I wish you all the luck in the world. It was great, and it was great talking to you.
Thank you, Mark. That was so much fun.
Neil Gaiman. I think I did all right with that. The Sandman is streaming on Netflix this Friday, August 5th. Please hang out for 1 second. Can you guys hang out? Can you? Just stay right there. All right, so look, I talked to James Acaster up in Montreal, and I'm going to post that episode on Thursday. We had a nice talk. You know, we got into it about an hour and a half, and I'd watched his stuff, and I was very impressed with his colored mic and his interesting mic cord, and I needed to know where he got it. We'll find out on Thursday. On August 10th, I will be at Largo. Here's where you go, largo-la.com. I will be there on August 10th. Okay? It's not on my site for some reason because I'm a fucking idiot. But this week I'll be in Columbus, Ohio at the Southern Theater on Thursday, August 4th. Indianapolis, Indiana, I'm at the Old National Center on Friday, August 5th. Louisville, Kentucky at the Baumhard Theater this Saturday, August 6th. What's that wheeze? Then I'm back at Dynasty Typewriter in L.A. on August 14th. That might be a Q&A show, I'm thinking. What do you think of that? Lincoln, Nebraska at the Rococo Theater on August 18th. Des Moines, Iowa at the Hoyt Sherman Place on August 19th. And Iowa City, Iowa at the Englert Theater on August 20th. In September, I'm in Tucson, Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, Boulder, Colorado, and Toronto, Ontario, Canada. In October, I'm in London, England, and Dublin, Ireland. Go to WTFpod.com/tour for all dates and ticket info. And again, Largo, I forgot. Is it too late to put it up on the site? Either way, largo-la.com if you want to go to Largo on the 10th. And that's good. That's about it. I think that's all I got to say. And now I'm going to go look at my Sandman comics. I pulled them all out and I got a lot more comics than I thought I did. I wouldn't call me a nerd or a collector, but I have a few. Now some extended guitar stuff. What is that? Sorry. I just hiccuped. Excuse me. Boomer lives. Monkey LaFonda. Cat angels everywhere.